How do you describe a good relationship? Welcome to the Good Word. This week we are back in the book of Genesis, and our topic is in Genesis chapters 12 to 17. And the topic is about Abraham and his relationship. I am Matilda Fry, professor of Old Testament at Walla Walla University in the School of Theology, and I am your host and study guide author. My conversation partners are Jody Washburn, professor of Old Testament in the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and Alden Thompson, emeritus professor of Old Testament from the Walla Walla University School of Theology. How would you describe a good relationship?
One in which you can quarrel and shout and understand each other and end the day in peace.
That's so succinct, you make it sound simple.
Oh, it's very simple.
Yeah, I thought of two things in response to your question. One, mutuality. That it's painful to be in a one-sided relationship, which I think we see often that pain expressed in the biblical text from both sides, right? Speeches framed as divine speeches, and also humans wrestling with their experience of their relationship with God. But even in our everyday relationships, I think we long for a mutuality there.
Don't we, in the Old Testament, given the authoritarian overlay, would we not expect to find more lopsided relationships in the Old Testament?
Well, to say something directly to the passage that we are talking about, I think for a long part in it, it is lopsided. God calls Abraham.
Yeah.
And Abraham goes, does, without questioning, without even saying a word. There is no speech, there is no dialogue. It is as if God is commanding from the top and Abraham is following. And that takes us from chapter 12 up to chapter 15 in the story. And that's when, for the first time, Abraham speaks up. And it looks like he's not a happy man there. At least when you read the way he responds to God, the way he asks the questions, even the address that he uses is so, it comes so explosively across that it feels that Abraham is really not in a good place there. And so when God says, oh, Abraham, I'm giving you all the blessings, and I am your protector. Remember, Abraham was on a battle in chapter 14. And then he comes home and he has brought in the victory. And he's the hero. And then suddenly he sits there and there is no one and he's all by himself alone. And God says, oh, by the way, I am protecting you. Don't you think it would have been nicer if he knew that before he went to fight? But that's not where God comes in. He comes afterwards and promises again, makes the same kind of promises that have not come through for the past 10 years, according to the time frames that we find in the biblical text from chapter 12 to chapter 15, 16. So about 10 years have passed, and there is no promise fulfilled in terms of the child that should come, the land that should be given to him, and so on. So he's in limbo. And he is not sure, where is my life going?
Yeah, and that idea of, like, if we go back to your earlier question, what makes a good relationship? One of the elements, I think, also is a dynamic nature. Like where it's emerging, it's changing, you're responsive. Each party is responsive to the other and to changing circumstances, etc. And that element of what you're saying about Abraham and some of these narratives being pretty explicitly, not totally one-sided, but God is the active partner. God is the one with more agency. I don't know what other words we could use. I mean, there seems to be a trajectory here I'm thinking in terms of Rabbi Nahum Ward Lev, who talks significantly about the different covenants and how when you get to Deuteronomy, for instance, and there's a renewal of the Sinai covenant, you have there an explicitly more dialogic relationship. So in other words, the people are invited to know more, but with that comes additional responsibility and more of this you know, what we could call mutuality or mutual responsibility. And so partly maybe what we're seeing is in the biblical text itself, the way that the divine-human relationship is conceived is dynamic. It's changing over time and from text to another text, from era to era, it's conceived in different ways. And we get to see that. I think of it as an invitation to be attentive even now to changes in how we understand the human and divine relationship.
I mean, if that word of God is one that is of life, it is dynamic.
Yes, growing. Yeah. It has to be growing, yes. Changing, adapting, mm-hmm. or it's dead.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this covenant ceremony, the one where you chop up all the animals and birds and so on. Mm-hmm. That's one-sided in a good way, one might say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your notes in the study guide were very intriguing there, Matilda. I think you ought to unpack that just a bit more for us.
He's asked to bring several animals, a heifer, a goat, and birds and so on, and then cut them in two pieces. And then he lays them across from each other and is even taking care of them, says the story, because the birds are coming down and so on. And then finally, when the sun comes down, Abraham is the text does not speak of this being a vision in the night and Abraham is tired and is falls asleep. No, he's in a vision that God has induced. And so there is darkness, terrible darkness and terror. So he is in great fear. And as he is in this state, he's watching. And the text describes a fiery torch passing between the pieces. Now, scholars have looked at this and found this as a kind of covenant ceremony that is very different from what we see later in other books in the Torah, in the Pentateuch, let's say in Exodus and then in Deuteronomy and so on. Here we have one that is probably rooted culturally in the very ancient world, and there are few documents that have come forth by archaeologists that help us understand a little bit of this text here in Genesis 15 with the animals. And so the covenant partners were supposed to pass between the pieces and then swear an oath that they would fulfill the conditions of the covenant. And if they would fail, then the curse would be upon them. The curse, which would mean to be cut up just like the animals.
Yes.
And so when Abraham watches here, he's not passing through the pieces between them. It is the fiery torch. Now, we are not told what that is right there in the story, so we have to read through further into the Hebrew Bible to recognize here a symbol or a way of a reference to the deity, to God, who offers this kind of covenant and offers himself to take upon himself that kind of promise to fulfill, and including that would also be the consequence that God is the one who takes upon himself even the curse.
Yes.
Here. And that is just like mind-boggling to read that in this story.
And that's something we can miss so easily, I think, from our perspective. Because I remember several years ago, for instance, learning about oaths. Like, if you made a promise in the ancient world, the way that you did that was through the means of conditional self-curses. That's what oaths often are. There's an element in there. Like we think of it often, think of the story of Jezebel. There's an example, right? Be it unto me and more also if by this time tomorrow I have not. You know, the idea is if I don't have him killed, let me be killed in the way that I'm asking him to be killed. This sort of conditional self-curse is how oaths were made. And these were not just words either. They were spoken, yes, as oaths, but they were embodied in many ways. Like if you think of other treaties from the ancient Near East, you have all kinds of examples that have curses like, as this doll is smashed, right? May you be shattered if you don't do your part of the covenant, the mm-hmm. treaty. If as this like wax figurine is melted in the fire, may you be melted down to nothing if you don't fulfill your part of this agreement. And so, thinking about this story and particularly that you know torch scene, with that background in mind, really adds to the punch, I believe, which is casting this deity, this Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, as a god who is upsetting categories, right? This is not something that would have been extremely surprising, right? That the deity, the one with more power, would take on all of the conditional self-curses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we rightly can say then that the covenant that is introduced here is one that is without conditions on Abraham and his descendants in that sense.
Yeah, which is also so interesting because when we list out the covenants in very simplified form, you know, you often hear people talk about, well, the covenant with Noah was unconditional, but the covenant with Abraham is conditional. And it's easy to make kind of quick categories, but we have in the narrative of Abraham, it cannot be reduced, I guess we could say, to those simple categories, because you have here this Yahweh taking on all, and then two chapters later, you have circumcision.
Mm-hmm. Now, that part about circumcision is another one that is hard for us to grasp, and it comes in chapter 17, and circumcision becomes the sign for this covenant ceremony.
Fortunately, we don't have enough time to discuss it.
Yes. It's a hard one, isn't it? Yes, it is.
So those who are listening will want to check the study guide because the study guide has some very good material on that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for this conversation about Abraham's relationship and God's relationship with Abraham. Many thanks to my conversation partners, Jody Washburn and Alden Thompson, and also to our program engineer, Lindsay Gisbert. And for all of you who listen in, thank you. For the Good Word, I'm Matilda Fry.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.